When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
He got hit here, and it was like he had a big cut here, and his eyes ball were out, and he's just hanging.
How do you help someone in that kind of situation?
I had no choice. He was almost dead, but he was still moving his like legs and hands.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Visit BetterHelp.com/Padilla because sometimes existing is exhausting.
Hello, Mingla G. Hello, Augie.
How are you?
How would you describe what you survived?
It was in 2015, April 25th. I was actually leading a big team on Everest. I had like almost like 24 or 25 clients. Everything got collapsed. And it was like huge snow, like a fall at a time, falling from like 6,500 meters all the way down to 5,000 meters. It was like very powerful when you hit the ground and it started blowing up. It was like very powerful. 18 people died, 6 from my team. Yeah. And one was my relatives, like a brother-in-law. It was the avalanche which came after the earthquake. 9,000 people were killed in Nepal. So it was just not just in the Everest Base Camp, but it was all over Nepal. In the beginning, we thought like it was very safe because we were in the like middle of the base camp, and it was like open, like empty, open place, and we were not like under the big buildings. After like 3 to 5 minutes, so we just heard a sound like boom. At once, and there was like snow rolling.
How much time did you have to react after seeing it?
Maybe less than like 2 minutes.
What was going on in your mind when you had that within that 2 minute span?
I was a bit lucky because I was a bit away from the center point.
You were just on the edge of it?
I was almost on the edge. When I ran back to my camp, I found nothing. My client from Netherlands, he was a cameraman on the team. So I just saw him like with his hanging skin on his face. Yeah.
So the avalanche settled.
Yeah, the avalanche came down and maybe it blew the rock. And I think he got hit with the rock and it got away his skin. And it was like hanging.
Just a skin flap.
It's like you know, the goat hanging with their like ears.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was something like that. The skin was hanging over there.
Whoa.
And his face was like full of blood. It was so difficult to recognize, and he was just like staying without, he was like unresponsive, like he was just staying like this. Then as we started searching like more and more friends. Then we saw the first body, that was one of my brother-in-law.
We were in Montecito, living in Montecito, and a series of fires had raged across the mountain range there, followed by some torrential rainpour, which caused a big slurry of mud to come down the hill and wipe out large chunks of Montecito. At the time, they had broken it into two distinct groups, the officials. They had voluntary evacuation and involuntary evacuation. They knew some rain was coming in. They thought it would be a lot. They wanted to be careful of flooding. They were mostly thinking about flooding. And so we were in an area called voluntary evacuation. They had had 3 involuntary evacuations prior to this one, and all having to do with the fire. So the fires were raging across, and when involuntary evacuations, you collect your animals and your precious belongings and you stick them in the back of your car and you leave the area along with the thousands of other people that are leaving the area and try to find a hotel or a place to sit for a day or two. It disrupts your entire life. This was the third or fourth one, and it was voluntary at this point.
Mm.
My family, my kid, my wife and daughter wanted to leave.
Yeah.
I was like, hell no.
You already did this twice.
I've done this, you know, and as sad as it sounds, it was the NCAA National Football Championship. Alabama was playing. And it was happening about that night, and I wanted to see a football game. I'm gonna sit there, and they are begging to leave, and you know, and I was like, if it's voluntary, we'll get some warning. It wasn't raining very hard. Mm. There was no problem before. It was a rain instead of fire, you know. And so I said, yeah, if you guys want to go to a hotel, absolutely. If there's a problem, I'll gather everything, put it in the car, and leave and meet you at the hotel if there's a problem later tonight. I'm staying. And so I went back to the football game. My lovely daughter, she was younger at the time, she got her pet rabbit and put it in a box and put it on the on the kitchen counter and said, "Dad, you know, if you make sure you get my rabbit." And we had a dog, and I said, "I'll get the rabbit, I'll get the dog, I'll get in the car, I'll leave." Mm-hmm. You know, that was it. At about 4 a.m, I woke up. It was quiet. And something felt weird. So I went outside and was looking at the drains. They looked clear. And then I saw up on the hill, up on this mountain to the right, this big orange glow. And I could just see these trees slapping down, just going bam, 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 way up. And then I could hear this low grade, like jet engine rumble, like a locomotive rumble. And I couldn't figure out what I was looking at. It was just such a bizarre thing to see in the way out there. And then as it got closer, I saw that it was a huge wall of just everything, trees and rocks and cars, and it's just rolling right, you know, 8 feet higher than I am, straight at me. And I was like, oh, and I ran. I thought I had enough time to get the dog, get in the car, which was behind the house, and drive away. I didn't have a minute. I had maybe 30 seconds. The dog was right there. I grabbed the dog by the collar. I reached for the bunny, but I missed him. I got, you know, towards the back of the house, and then the whole slide hit me and caved in. I'm a huge tree, speared right through one side. And these boulders, you know, you would think a boulder wouldn't move, but these are, you know, 20,000 pound boulders. They're the size of a pickup truck, and whatever they touch just goes away. And they just started punching through, the mud came up, and I'm struggling and pinned up against the fireplace, and the dog was under the mud. And
did you think that you were dead?
I thought, I mean, it was so powerful. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And that mountain is about 3,000 foot elevation, so it's a massive amount of rain. It just picked up all the mud and picked up all the rock. There was nothing to stop it, and it just continued to build and build. And by the time it hit the base where our house was, it was unstoppable. I found out later our room was the first thing just sheared off. If I had been asleep, it was gone within seconds. They just went right through, took out the room, took out the garage, took out the cars, just everything swept to the ocean. But then what happened was that some big boulder or tree punched through all the way through the house, and all the mud went that way. The pressure got out, and I could get over I didn't realize I still had the dog in my car. It came up out of the mud and still alive. And I got through, fought my way into a low pressure zone. And there the mud was maybe 2 feet.
Okay.
We had two cats too, and they were in there, I could see, and they were bouncing around in the mud trying to, I thought, you know, but I still had the dog, and I dragged him up on this landing that we had going upstairs. And the mud was filling that room though. Mm. And we had a window, so I kicked it out on the way up, going up the thing, and then the mud went cascading out the house. And then I got up to the next floor, and I thought, you know, it's still here, and part of the house is still up. And I look up, and there's my daughter and my wife. They had not gone to the thing.
You thought they were gone?
I thought they were gone, and they were there. And then also my son had come in from college, and he was there. He had come in late that night. So one of my three sons was there too. And then I'm just looking at them, and they're looking at me, and we're like, I could not believe it. I said, well, get on, you know, I've seen, you know, some movies where you get on the roof. Let's get on the roof and let's get to the most stable thing. And we built this beautiful stone fireplace. So I threw everyone up on the roof, and then we just held on to the fireplace thing. And that was big and wide. And then mud had now come on either side of the house and was chipping away the house underneath. For about 15 minutes there, unbelievable flow. I mean, I saw things coming down, you know, whole chunks of concrete abutment, you know, huge propane tanks. And what had happened, it turned out that glow up on the hill that I'd really seen is one of the big gas mains had sheared off. And it had exploded, blew up a house, and it was shooting fire, and that was the glow that you saw. And we had one of those gas mains too, and about when we're up there, it sheared off. And all of a sudden, there's just this jet engine of gas, propane, shooting up out of the mud, right by our house, and it was just thick with propane in the air. And I thought we were going to have just an explosion. I thought it was just going to, you know, we're going to blow up there. And it was that moment that, you know, I looked to my daughter and said, I'm so sorry if this goes the wrong way. I'm sorry that you're in this position, because I felt like I killed my family.
What are you thinking? Are you like, I got to rescue people?
I was very nervous, but I had to think a little bit, right? Because I was the head of the team. So I had to manage everything, because most of my staffs, they were very scared. Try to convince like my team, like all my Sherpa team, like, okay, we need to like help everyone to get in safe place first. All the like those other clients who were like safe, they came together and we started like finding more and more. It was like very difficult situations where I could barely remember all my team members. So I said, okay, like you find your partner, you find your partner. Then we started finding more people. So we found like all the alive one and six dead. There was a team just next to our, and most of their team members, they were in a higher camp, not in the base camp. And we found like two members from their team, they were also dead. There were like lots of other climbers from different teams who were on the top of the base camp. Base camp was a bit safe, so they came down, helped us a lot to carry our injured people to safer place.
You mentioned in your documentary one of the people that was really shocking for me to hear was where like some of the poles from the tent had.
Yeah, that was my Chinese brother. He was sleeping, so he was naked. He just had a jacket, and then it looks like he was hit by a pole. The pole was blown and he got hit here. And it was like, he had a big cut here and his eyes ball were out and he's just hanging.
His eye was hanging?
Yeah.
How do you help someone in that kind of situation?
I had no choice. He was almost dead, but he was still moving his like legs and hands.
But like nothing going on in his head?
Yeah, like he could not speak anything, but he was just moving his hand and legs. So I just saw his eyes out. It was like a bit difficult. I just put it inside and just put his cap down.
I didn't know you could do that.
I had to leave him die there, because it was not possible for us to save him. If he was alone, he was the only person who got injured or who got hit by avalanche, then maybe there was a way to save him. But the whole the base camp was hit by avalanche, and there were like hundreds of people who got injured there.
So you had to start prioritizing who was savable.
Yeah, it was the best idea. Because those who died, we better not take care of those.
Right.
Instead we could save more lives, right? The Chinese guy was so close to me, so I had to, it was so difficult to leave him, just like struggling to die. I spent almost like half to 40 minutes staying with him to calm down. Like I was just waiting for him to stop, like to die.
You just have to support him and
yeah,
show.
I tried to catch a little bit and just try to rub. I could do that only. On the day, it was horrible.
Well, after about 15 minutes, that area, we didn't go anywhere. We were still, and then the pressure on the mud started to go down. I got down there and it was about neck high, but I could manage it. It wasn't taking me downstream. I waited about 10 more minutes and then it got down to about my chest and it stayed there. And I got my family off the roof, held hands and walked our way in up to where was a safer area. And I went up to the firemen who had pre-positioned, and I told them, you know, we're alive and we're here, and they got their boots on and started coming down the road. I was just worried about this one single mom and her two kids, which I couldn't find. And so he strapped up with a couple of his guys and he came down with me back through the mud. We looked around, and at about that time, one a debris pile, there was a little noise coming out of it, and you could see a little arm, you know, moving. And the fire captain got every fireman, you know, that we could find, and everyone was just ripping at the pile, and got down to the bottom of it, and it was just a little muddy baby, and alive. And you think about that, I mean, how it could, I don't know how it survived. It was just a little baby, couldn't swim, couldn't do anything. It had been torn out of its house a half a mile upstream, been in that huge mass of concrete and rebar and everything, hit our house, smashed in, been piled up with pile all over it, and then survived for at least an hour, hour and a half.
Whew.
And a baby survived. And
wow.
And lost his mom and his family, but he survived.
Oh, man.
And I'm still friends with the baby to this day, and we did some fundraising for him, and he's a great kid. I lost good friends in the mud, and one of my best friends and his daughter, and they were in an involuntary evacuation zone, and but he decided to stay too, and lost his life and his daughter. So there's some, I mean, it was truly tragic.
There were 17 lives lost.
Yeah.
But for some reason, you know, like, how does that make you feel knowing that for some reason you're okay and your family's okay?
Yeah, I wasn't a spiritual person. You know, I'm not particularly spiritual, you know, that type of thing. But we had lost our oldest son to a training accident a few years before at UCSB, you know, here in town. And he was a great guy. And, you know, my wife and daughter decided to stay in his room. You know, his room survived, you know, and it was one of the room that saved them was his room. And, you know, it just felt like everything was in some way, you know, guided. I don't understand how we all survived.
The last person in the team was a Japanese guy. Could see him nowhere. And we found him other side of the camp. Mm-hmm. I think he also started running and maybe hit somewhere. And he broke his both legs. And his like hand was twisted a bit more like this.
Mm.
And he was lying on his hand.
Mm.
So both legs were damaged. Like broken, is this hand was totally like twisted, broken, and this I think he got broken somewhere else, so it was difficult. And he was just under snow, and he was just moving with this one hand a little bit, and his face was moving something like that. I just had to grab him on his back and pull him out of the snow and drag him on the safer place.
Did he survive?
No. He died in Kathmandu. So he was okay. All the night we helped him. And he started talking a little bit. He could remember a little bit. He was hospitalized, just reached the hospital. And there was another aftershock. And everyone started running. And maybe it looks like he got heart attack. Because,
From the fear?
Yeah, from the fear.
You finally have everyone accounted for.
Yeah.
But you don't feel safe, and there's so many injured people. You've witnessed so many people dying.
Mm.
What do you do with the people there while you're waiting for rescue?
In a tent, we lots of people sleeping together.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
We spent a horrible night that day.
So how many days until you were finally rescued?
One night.
Did you have any moment to sit with your emotions or your thoughts in that time?
Most like around 6-7 o'clock in the evening, when everyone got rescued. Then we got a little bit time to hang on the internet because we also need to inform the family. And then I realized that there was earthquake. This epicenter was in my hometown, not in Everest Base Camp.
You thought that it must have been in Base Camp?
Yeah, we thought it was in Base Camp, but it was in my hometown. We were expecting like a helicopter early in the morning. At 9 o'clock, finally there was like a small window opening, so the heli could enter the Everest Base Camp and it started rescuing. So there were like 12 out of dead bodies at base camp. So we just wrapped them in a like a torn tin or in a plastic bag. So we just had to like throw like this.
So how does that sit with you having that treating dead bodies like they're just a log?
That was a horrible experience in my life. First time I had like so many dead bodies in front of me on the mountain, just and also it was like just throwing.
Yeah.
On the first day, like when we found most of the dead bodies, they were like warm. And on the second day, everything was cold.
So they're more stiff and didn't really feel like a person as much?
Right. Mm. Two dead bodies we found the next day only. So we were a little frozen and the hand was something like this. So we had to grab it and put it back. It was like breaking the hands.
Oh.
Because we could not put it in the helicopter, something like this. And uh-huh. There's like more. We didn't have like that much sense to think too much. We lost all our mind. Mm. We're just working whatever like we felt.
Like on autopilot.
Yeah, out of yeah. So everything we just were doing anything like on the spot, but there was not like thinking long or thinking too many things.
Do you feel like you've processed it now? Do you feel like you're okay with all that stuff now, or is there ever a point where you can feel okay?
I feel okay now, but now like if something happens on the mountain, I have now very calm nature.
Really?
Yeah, I can easily handle. Like this year, just in 2022, we had another avalanche on a mountain called Manaslu. Six of my Sherpa, they were climbing up, and they were taken down by avalanche. Two of them were very critical. One broke his leg, one got hit on his head, and his face was all swollen. And some of my guides, they were like so scared. And I said like, don't worry, be calm. Just speak slowly, what's going on there? I had a few cases. Now I feel like so calm. So whatever happens on the mountain, I can easily handle now.
You're able to talk about it in a way where it doesn't feel like you're, like it's just tearing you up at all times.
For a few days, it was so difficult. Like I had that incident like coming in my mind frequently.
Just keep popping up.
Yeah, keep popping. But now, I think because I have these stories in many places now, so I feel a bit comfortable, but when I speak these things, it's still like my head, it gets like kind of like a bit headache.
You get a headache
it's
talking
like
about?
It's like bit pain.
Mm. Yeah.
It's like something here, like just this part. Just like...
Just the memories, yeah, just thinking right. about the memories right, yeah. is painful.
Because when I talk these things, I just remember him like struggling to die.
And those are the types of images that just don't leave your mind. They sit with you.
Yeah, right. I think that made me a bit stronger. Now, like I see, like people dying. I see, like I find myself like it's part of life.
And I can't go without thanking BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. Therapy has helped reframe my view of the world by allowing me to feel empathy for my younger self and therefore understand who I am today better. But therapy can be customized to whatever is right for you and can be useful in helping with motivation or feelings of depression, anxiety, stress, insecurity, or whatever else you might need. BetterHelp screens all their therapists to ensure that they have experience and that they're certified and licensed, and provides customized therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't even have to see anyone or speak over the phone if that's not something that you're entirely comfortable with. One of the hardest parts about getting into therapy is finding that therapist that you actually connect with, and the price of going through multiple therapists can start to add up, which is why BetterHelp offers a more affordable alternative to in-person therapy where you can start communicating with your therapist in less than 48 hours. So huge thank you to BetterHelp for giving us Spent a Day with viewers and listeners 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Padilla. That's betterhelp.com/Padilla. And I can't go without thanking Dipsy for sponsoring this episode. Dipsy, of course, is an app full of short audio stories designed by women for women. They bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and characters, and content is released every single week. So in between listening to your favorite stories, you can always find something new to explore. Dipsy also has sleep stories, wellness sessions, and now they also offer written stories. So no matter how you like to consume these delectable little morsels, you're set. And for I Spent a Day with viewers and listeners of the podcast, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/Padilla. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/PADILLA. Again, and I'm only going to say this once more, dipsystories.com/Padilla. Now back to the world of natural disaster survivors.
Did any of that reframe the way that you think about your life?
Yeah, money used to mean something to me. Mm. It doesn't mean very much to me anymore.
What matters more to you now?
Time with family, 100%. Mm. You know, really what I learned from that is that all your things, all the things I saved are inconsequential. They really don't matter. I had a baseball card, a Mickey Mantle baseball card. Mm. I had that thing was my, I have it, you know, mm-hmm. and gone, you know, and I'm the same person I was with or without.
Yeah.
You know?
Like,
things are immaterial. Things are immaterial. Mm. And that's kind of given me the feeling I can be or do anything I want.
I feel like a lot of people would live their life differently if they had the confidence in it, if they lost the the thing, if they risked something and it went away or failed, that it would be okay, life would be okay, yeah. That they would try a lot more things.
Yeah, they would try, and you can always rebuild. You can always rebuild. It, you know, you just, if you could do it once, you could do it again. That's what I learned. Mm. And what was crazy is when we came back, they closed off the whole area because they didn't want looters or anything.
Yeah.
But we got in, and we came in through mud that was, you know, still 3 feet high. Our house sitting there on the stump was the rabbit in its cage. And it had been buried in the cage in the mud, but just its head was under it. And then some firemen found it and got the mud off of it, and it survived. And it was in the cage sitting there as we walked up to the thing. And our dog survived. And 3 or 4 weeks later, we came back again. Then they closed everything off, and they let us in, and we go up to where my son's room, Nick's room, was still alive, still there, and we opened the door, and our cats had been sleeping on his bed. They survived in that mud thing too. Everyone survived.
Cats, that is insane.
Rabbit, it was crazy.
Do you ever feel any survivor's guilt or anything?
No, I really miss my good friend, and his daughter. He was a hand surgeon, and everyone knew him in town. Great family. They grew up with my family, known each other forever. Mm-hmm. And for them to lose both of them was, you know, it was preventable. And I feel, you know, I miss them every day. And I don't feel survivor's guilt, though. I don't feel that at all. I think I'm sad for those people that are missing, but I'm so happy for everyone else that survived. Mm. Many people were rescued. People survived, and I would rather celebrate those that survived.
How do you feel about life and death now? Has it changed the way that you think about when you'll live, when you'll die?
So, like, if there's time you die, you will die. We have lots of stories where our friends die just in the bathroom, just taking shower and fall down, hit somewhere and died. If your destiny is to live 100 years, you do whatever, you'll stay alive. If your destiny is just like 40 years, 30 years, you're gonna die anyway. So just going on the stairs, you may fall down. Just like while driving, you just hit somewhere. Mm. I think it's just a destiny. So
you're not afraid that you're gonna put yourself in situations where you'll die because you you'll die either way at some point in your life, regardless of what you're doing?
Yeah, because I've tried so many hard routes on the different mountains. I'm a bit scared. Sometimes like I might get like frostbite, or I might fall down and break my hands or legs, and I get like paralyzed. But with the life, I don't get fear. Because if there is destiny, you're gonna die, you're gonna die.
How do you find solace in that mindset?
So my father, he got a frostbite in 1983, when I was not born. So he had to cut his 8 fingers.
He lost 8 fingers?
Yeah, he lost 8 fingers climbing with the Japanese team.
Which fingers did he have left?
He just got like 2 thumbs.
Just 2 thumbs?
Yeah. The thumbs are very important to put the
fingerprints?
Yeah, fingerprints.
So he can still do his fingerprints and do thumbs
up. Yeah, he got like a half. So we got like 1, 2, 3, right?
Yeah,
so
you mean the knuckle?
He just got only one.
He had one of these
half. My mother saw those things from their like young age. They just got married maybe after like 3-4 years. My father got like this frostbite, and they struggled all their life. And even like because of them, we also struggled from our childhood. My mother, she never wanted me to climb because she saw her husband.
She saw what happened to your father.
Yeah, what happened to my father. But for me, it was like interest. Because my uncle, they used to be a guide. My father used to be a guide. Mm-hmm. So I used to have lots of stories from them when I was like a child. And after I finished my schooling, I wanted to have a kind of experience, their life. So I just joined expeditions. After that, I got like a kind of like addictions.
You were addicted to climbing?
Mm. Actually, I just wanted to see how their life was, how they spent their life. Because we used to hear lots of stories of this climbing. I just wanted to experience myself.
I was trying to figure out how to prevent the next one. I was going to fire prevention meetings for a while after that.
You're like right to the source.
Right, yeah, let's go. How do we stop that from happening? Mm. And I read a 1970s forestry department a study on how to reduce fire behavior effect on hills. And they said, you ought to plant agave and prickly pear cactus. So I started going to these meetings and saying, if anyone has some defensible space, I will plant agave in your defensible space. And people started to raise their hands. And I met a farmer and we started growing plants. And I've got thousands of agave up there in the Montecito Hills, all the way up to Buellton, that are in strips to protect against the next fire. But sure enough, there was a fire a couple years ago, and one of our strips, it stopped the fire dead, and all the buildings that were on the other side were protected. So it actually works. And then that got me the idea, once I started learning about agave, why don't I try to use some of these mature plants and make tequila out of them.
There you go.
So I started a tequila company.
And it was an accident. There were so many of these things in your life that have been like, this accidentally happened, and because of that accident, this good thing happened, or this tough thing happened, and this.
Why don't we do something positive out of it?
Do you have a tequila business?
I have a tequila company. Yeah, yeah. And it's called Firebreak Tequila, which is because of the fire. You know, it stops the Firebreak Tequila.
That's so cool.
It's weird how you can use judo and kind of get around make something positive out of that.
So there's a mountain just in front of my house. It's like an hour walk from my home. I climbed it successfully. But when I reached the summit, it was only like 4 o'clock, and I had a bit of bad luck. It was like beautiful weather, and it changed. And it was like cloudy again. I could barely see my toes, like my legs. And my mother was there at the home.
She's like my son who just survived an avalanche and an earthquake.
And she was there for like
six of his team members died, and now he's stuck on a mountain for 2 nights.
Yeah, right. 2 months prior that, she just lost her husband.
So you were, that was almost horrible. You're putting your mom through a lot.
Yeah, then, after that, she never wanted me to climb?
Yeah, I would say no. You're done climbing. Yeah.
But the good thing is that my mother still lives in the village, and we don't have network there.
Yeah.
And I'm in Kathmandu or climbing on the mountain.
Oh, so she doesn't know you're climbing.
Yeah, yeah. So I never tell her. So I just tell her like I'm going to this mountain and I'm going to be at base camp, but just go climb, come back.
So she just assumes that you're safe.
Yeah.